So today, I want to wrap up the course by talking about gravitational instantons. And I think this is quite a nice topic to finish on because it brings together features that we've been discussing throughout the course. We're going to use calculating the action of solutions. We're going to be talking about Euclidean solutions, and also the underlying theme of this is going to be the sort of not so much confronting, but how do we do quantum processes in the presence of gravity? Because usually it's quite challenging. We don't really have a theory of quantum gravity, and yet what we've seen as we've gone through this course is that it is possible to think about quantum processes in gravity, so black hole thermodynamics, for example. So in this particular lecture, we're thinking about quantum tunneling. And I think tunneling is maybe one of the most startling implications of quantum physics. So classically, we hit a barrier and that's the end of the story. But quantum mechanically, it's a very different situation. So we have this intuition from our Schrödinger equation that we're not really definitely here, we're just somehow mostly here, sort of largely localized, but the fact is, we're more described by a wave function, and even if a regime is classically forbidden, all that means is there's some sort of barrier, and our wave function can only completely come to a dead stop at a barrier if that barrier is infinite, and most barriers are not infinite. Therefore, our wave function leaks out into these forbidden regions, and if there's an allowed region on the other side, it can then become a sort of meaning, have a little tail on the other side. And so that story we call tunneling because it really is as if we are building a little tunnel through a barrier, through some hill that allows us to go through to the other side. So this is summarizing what I said. We understand tunneling as a process of damping, but not killing, of the wave function. But obviously, we need to be able to calculate it. So I want to just give a sort of motivation of the particular tool that we use and was largely developed by Sidney Coleman, amongst others, back in the 70s. So let's just remind ourselves of what we know about the Schrödinger equation. So when we first do quantum mechanics, we have a square barrier. We're usually doing either square barriers or square wells. And let's suppose our barrier is D wide. And we have an incoming stream of particles and a reflected part and a transmitted part. So I'm going to assume that the amplitude of the particles coming in is unity. And here, the difference between the energy of the particle and the height of the barrier is going to be delta V. So in those circumstances, because it's a nice clean square barrier, we just solve the Schrödinger equation. So our transmission probability, we can find it precisely because, you know, on the left-hand side, we have two oscillatory sort of real, if you like, wave functions, e to the I omega t. Inside, we've got two exponentials. And on this side, we just have an outgoing wave function to the right. And we simply apply boundary conditions. We get this result. But we notice that as long as the barrier is significant, this result is sharply dominated by an exponential tail. And the size of the exponent is given by the essentially the fall off, the damping, the exponential damping of the wave function under the barrier. So of course we set h bar to 1, and I'm just setting m to 1 for convenience. So that's our result from standard quantum mechanics. But now I want to consider something different. So I'm going to consider a classical particle just in a potential well of depth delta V. And so what happens is the particle kind of falls down, picks up kinetic energy, goes along the bottom, goes back up again, and then repeats. So we have that a half x dot squared is delta V along the bottom. And so if I want to integrate from 0 to d of this root 2 delta v, this is equal to the integral from of root 2 delta v x dot dt. But of course, my x dot is also 2 delta v. So that's 2 delta v dt, which is the integral of delta v plus delta v, which is a half x dot squared dt. In other words, that is the Euclid, the action, or Hamiltonian, if you like, of that particle. So this is the total energy of the particle. So I should have sort of said here that this 2 omega d is like the integral of twice the integral of omega dx between naught and d, which is of course the integral of root 2 delta v naught to d. So if I look at what I've got there and I want to know what my integral is, then I can relate my integral of root 2 delta v to a sort of total action or Hamiltonian or Euclidean action of a classical particle moving in the potential well. Thank you. So we have this kind of curiosity in a way. In essence, what I've actually done here is I have wick rotated. I've gone to Euclidean time, which has the effect of inverting my potential, and the action of this sort of rather abstract process tells me the leading order contribution to my tunneling probability. So it's not meant to say this is exactly what it is. In this case, this is just a sort of motivating sort of little speech, if you like, as to how you might calculate the tunneling rate. So in general, so for example, if we think about alpha decay in a nucleus, we can sort of represent the potential for the alpha particle. It's got a local minimum, because obviously the nucleus is roughly stable, but it's lower energy if the alpha particle is outside the nucleus, so we expect it to tunnel through that barrier. And if we want to calculate the amplitude of that, what we do is we invert the potential, and then we find the classical process here, where we roll to an exit point, and obviously here we'll roll back again. So that's our classical Euclidean trajectory. We compute the Euclidean action of that, and that gives us this bounce. So that used to be called a bounce because it was a sort of there and back again trajectory. And so that whole process is what, if you like, from this square well barrier would give you the factor of 2. Now this is, you know, the way I presented it, this is more heuristic. It's simply giving a justification or perhaps a little bit of insight into why this Euclidean process works. But it's really just because what you're doing when you're tunneling, if you think about a particle tunneling in general number of dimensions, it's kind of looking, if you imagine the wave function of the particle and how it's exponentially damped under a barrier, what it's going to do is it's going to look for the most probable escape path. And so, because that's the one where it's like the shortest distance through the barrier. And so what you're trying to do is to find this route through the barrier that gives you the shortest possible distance, where distance is, of course, weighted via a sort of Lagrangian. And so the easiest way, or a very intuitive way of calculating that, is to do this Euclidean trick, which is to kind of invert, if you invert the barrier, and then you're kind of looking for a sort of stationary route through out to the other side. So that's kind of sort of hand-wavy motivation of why we do this. Now, of course, the Schrödinger equation is non-relativistic. It's not what we actually tend to do in quantum field theory. We are working with relativistic fields. So we don't have barriers as functions of position. We have potentials of our fields. We have a V of phi. And so we consider, if you like, our barrier becomes an interaction potential. And so we might have something like this. I'm only going to be thinking about scalar fields. So this is a sort of V of phi. And I might have a potential that has another minimum, or perhaps I'm actually, potential just keeps getting more and more negative. Either way, this point here is a local minimum, so it's sort of in part stable, but because there is a lower energy region over here, it's not completely stable, it's just some local minimum. So we call this the false vacuum, because if we quantize around that point, we will see that we get things that are approximately looking like particle states around that vacuum, but they will have a very small tail, if you like, complex component that is telling you about this. When you put it in your e to the is on h bar, it's giving you this tunneling rate, okay? So this, if this were a local minimum, this would be a true vacuum. So this was the problem that Coleman and others were considering in the 70s. Once again, you know, at the time, people were beginning to really understand how field theory worked, understand the Standard Model, and this idea of the vacuum being quite a, you know, quite a complicated object. It wasn't necessarily a single point or a single value of the field. And indeed, what you mean by the vacuum, it turns out, changes once you're looking at field theory at finite temperature, because you get various corrections due to finite temperature. So all these different implications were being worked out. And it was, you know, kind of realized that if you thought about quantum fields in the early universe, maybe they ended up trapped in a false vacuum. So people really wanted to understand what was the implication of this false vacuum. And given that people knew about quantum tunneling, when you see some state like I've drawn there, you sort of expect that it's metastable. So how do you calculate that metastability? How do you come up with a number that's going to tell you the probability of decay if you find yourself in that state? So that's the paper by Coleman. And honestly, I can recommend these papers. You know, quite often research papers are a bit impenetrable when you first pick them up, but these are actually pretty good. So I reckon you'll be able to pick these up and read them. So Coleman considered this sort of potential. So we're going to write I'm going to work pretty much following his general argument, but perhaps using language that's more in keeping with our gravitational course here. So I'm going to look at a scalar field. So first of all, I'm going to forget about gravity. So we're just going to go through and follow Coleman's original paper. And I'm going to construct a potential that looks very much like what I drew there in the solid line. It's got two minima, and one of them is just a little bit lower than the other one. So here's the bit that's the big picture, the two minima, and here is a little tilt. So I'm taking the two minima, and I'm just adding a little something. So epsilon is meant to be small. So here, if phi equals eta, V is zero, and this is the true vacuum. And if phi equals minus eta, then V is epsilon, and this is very close to the false vacuum. I say very close because V primed is kind of obviously not quite zero there. But anyway, so this is sort of, let me put a little squiggle here. So this is meant to be representing where the vacua are. So our Euclidean trick says I'm going to look at the, I'm obviously going to look at the action of these various field configurations for phi, but I'm going to do it in Euclidean time. This would be the general Euclidean solution. So that underlined grad here is actually just Cartesian, you know, R cubed standard vector calculus grad squared. So obviously you could have all sorts of solutions to this. It could be a complete mess. But if what we're looking for is the easiest way out, we want the lowest action. We want the least energy solution. So typically, if we think about what it's going to look like, our agenda is we're going to say, imagine that we have false vacuum. So I have if I just sketch what I've got, here I've got phi as minus eta throughout all of space. So that is a configuration I would expect to be unstable, but how might it decay? How might we get true vacuum? Well, we don't expect for it suddenly to transition everywhere, because that would be an infinite amount of energy, because we have to go over the barrier. On the other hand, if we have we could imagine getting some, let me just draw it an arbitrary shape first, we could imagine getting some small finite region which goes to the true vacuum of plus eta, and we could imagine something like that happening, because in a finite region, it just costs a finite amount of energy to jump over that barrier. So we could expect something like that. So this is reminiscent of a first order phase transition. It's a bit like boiling water. We get bubbles of water, of steam inside the liquid. And if we then use that intuition, that says, well, actually, this is not what I would expect. What I would expect is a nice round bubble. Because if I think of the cost, you know, the whole process is we're looking for the cheapest way through the barrier. So the cost of that process is going to be building this wall here, this boundary between the true and false vacuum. We gain by making true vacuum because we lose that bit of energy inside. So intuitively, we would expect round bubbles to appear. And we also have this notion that there's going to be a critical size of bubble. So if the bubble is too small, there's a lot of surface area and very little volume, so it's going to squash in on itself. If it's big, then you've got a better ratio of surface area to volume, but it also costs more to make a big bubble. So we have this sort of Goldilocks type situation here where there's going to be a just right bubble. So let's sort of see that from our Euclidean perspective. Thank you. So let me just argue it again intuitively before going and giving a little bit more rigor by looking at this, you know, this equation. So we're producing, we're thinking maybe we're going to produce a bubble of true vacuum here. Okay, so it's, we gain from the vacuum transition. And so what we gain is the volume inside the bubble. So our difference in energy is epsilon. So, and the volume inside, don't forget we're in four dimensions, four Euclidean dimensions here. So the volume of a bubble is pi squared on 2 times r to the fourth. We then have a cost of the bubble wall. And so that's going to be its area, which is 2 pi squared r cubed times its energy per unit area. So that would be what I would expect if I were just saying a bubble is round and it's got a radius r, the bubble wall has an energy sigma, and the vacuum transition gives me an epsilon back. So there, I simply say, well, I need to balance these by taking d by dr and setting it to zero. So that tells me 2 pi squared r cubed epsilon is going to equal 6 pi squared r squared sigma. And so that tells me that r is equal to 3 sigma on epsilon. So that's my hand-waving intuitive argument. And it's largely what Coleman used, but let's actually see why this is a reasonable thing to do. So let's go back and look for our solutions to this field equation. So if we take that spherical symmetry, the bubble being round, that means I'm going to look for a solution in terms of rho, where rho is the tau squared plus x squared. So then I look back at my equation here, and I'm going to obviously convert this into polar coordinates and say it just depends on rho, and then I'm going to forget about that epsilon piece because it's subdominant. So that gives me this equation of motion for phi. Now, if it weren't for this piece, if I ignored that, we've already seen that because I talked about these domain wall solutions when we were doing the warped extra dimensions. So, if I ignore that piece in the box, I would say I can solve that equation. I know what the answer is. It's a Tansch profile. And if I write down that Tansch profile and then ask how big is that 3 phi primed over rho piece, well, phi primed is only significant in the vicinity of rho naught. So if rho naught is big, then this term is small compared to these two terms when they're non-zero. And so obviously this isn't a complete solution, but you know that if you wrote some delta phi and then try to find delta phi from the field equation, this correction would be much smaller than this background Tansch solution. So it's a good approximation. So in fact, that's kind of where Coleman started. He said, you know, we have the Euclidean solutions. As long as the bubble is big, this is going to be a good approximation to what it looks like. But then actually, I don't really need to input that necessarily into into my action, because of course this rho naught at the moment is a free parameter, and what you're looking for is a stationary point of the action. So, you know, strictly speaking, you're looking at varying, you know, throughout a whole configuration space of phi, but of course here the action has kind of two pieces. We've got for the wall, so this is our scalar field action, Euclidean action, for the wall. And this simply ends up being, to a good approximation, sigma. Remember when we had our wall here, it had sigma of proportional to root lambda eta cubed. I think the constant of proportionality was 4/3. That was what we showed. So when you integrate out this whole, you know, the action has, strictly speaking, dependence on all four Euclidean coordinates, you kind of see, because of the solution, this dominant solution that just depends on the radial coordinate, it simply integrates out, giving you the energy per unit area of the wall, which was kind of what I assumed over here, that there would be a cost to making the wall. So now we know what that cost is relative to the constants of the theory. So the coupling constant, the self-coupling of phi, and its vacuum expectation value, eta. And then, of course, the other part of our action, so this is just of the wall, is going to come from looking at the difference in vacuum energy. So we get the pi squared on 2, r to the fourth epsilon. So this justifies the Goldilocks argument. Moreover, I argued we're only looking for a stationary solution, so if we restrict our field configurations to depend on a single unknown parameter, rho naught or r, I can then just, this taking d by dr is then equivalent to doing this minimization over the full scalar field problem. And I find that my r, which is 3 sigma on epsilon, is going to be very big because epsilon is assumed to be small. So it's all self-consistent, and our picture is very much that of a bubble with a wall that's spherical and the wall is thin. So the bounce action, our probability, SB, turns out to be so I put in this value of R and I put it into the combination of the vacuum energy gain and the bubble wall cost, and I find the overall cost of making this bounce or this bubble is proportional to sigma to the fourth and epsilon cubed. Now, how is this a bounce in the sense of Coleman and co? So if you imagine, this is Euclidean time here. So we start in the false vacuum, and then in a given region, we've transitioned to true. We then have a point where the size of the bubble is maximal in Euclidean time, and we carry on and we go back to false. So it's a bounce in that sense. But of course, it's still a Euclidean solution. So we have to analytically continue to get our real-time solution. So tau squared plus x squared was equal to rho squared, if you remember, so, and which was r squared. So that becomes minus t squared plus r squared equals capital R squared. So our Lorentzian solution, if we analytically continued the whole sphere, would become a hyperboloid. So here is our Lorentzian solution. And it's a bubble, but the bubble is actually expanding and at a constant acceleration. So this is false vacuum and inside is true vacuum. And so the picture that Coleman gives us is that at t equals zero, or whatever, a bubble forms that's initially just instantaneously stationary, and then it starts to expand. And so you see that gradually it eats up the whole of the space by this accelerated expansion. So that's Coleman's picture, where he gives concrete results without having to solve the Euclidean field equations for a specific potential. Of course, it's very, very easy now to just ask your favorite algebraic manipulator program to do the integral for you, and you can very easily integrate the phi field, so it would be this equation of motion. It's very easy to just integrate that up numerically to find out what your field profile is. You pop it back into the action, and then you find what the tunneling result is. And in fact, it's Coleman's answer, which assumes this thin wall, is really, really good. The only time it gets bad is when the barrier gets very, very shallow, or, you know, it's a sort of competition between the size of the barrier and the vacuum energy difference. But it's a very, very good approximation over a wide range of potentials. Okay, so the story there was that we kind of had, if we just looked at the bubble solution, we had this sort of, you know, parameter, rho naught or r, that we had to find by a minimization principle. But this is a gravitational physics course, so of course we want to now think, what happens if we add gravity? So that was what Coleman came back to with De Lucia just a few years later. So if we think, I'm going to stick to this particular example where I'm going from a positive energy to zero, simply because it's easier to draw pictures for it. So if I ask, what is the implication of adding gravity? If we have a false vacuum that has a finite energy, then that means we have a lambda, because our energy momentum tensor has that combination of derivatives of phi and the potential for phi. So having a lambda, having a V of phi false vacuum bigger than zero implies we've got a lambda false vacuum, which is 8 pi g epsilon. So that means we have De Sitter space. So our whole picture now of the tunneling is going to change. Here I just drew a sort of sheet of paper, if you like, representing an infinite plane. But that's no longer true when we include gravity. So Euclidean De Sitter is a four-sphere with psi radius with with a radius defined by the cosmological constant. So if we have a small vacuum energy, it means we've got a big S4. So things are almost flat, but not quite. So the wall itself So we could actually, this is again a choice of how we do this. We could do the same Goldilocks argument if we want. We could say the cost of the bubble wall, we have a bubble of radius r, and where we now have to be a little more careful what we mean by r. So what we're going to mean by r is it's the size of three spheres in our space. So we're in a sort of area gauge. So the cost of the bubble wall is going to be the same, but now the gain from the vacuum transition is going to be different because the interior of a bubble on a four sphere, so if I sketch here just my sphere, if I imagine cutting out some circle, let's say here, of radius r, so this is area 2 pi squared r cubed, the interior of that is not a sort of flat space interior, it's the interior of this, the sort of full volume, if you like, of the cap of the sphere. So we can do that integral and then we can play our game of minimizing with respect to r. But of course we have a different way of doing it, which is going to be equivalent, which is finding the using the Israel equations. So I just like to do that because it's an example of this process. So here we have our exterior geometry is the four sphere. Our interior geometry is flat. And of course, our Israel conditions say we take a boundary. So our boundary, which is the wall, so we take some rho that corresponds to the position of the wall and some chi that corresponds to the position of the wall, but it has to have the same geometry. So our two radii here have to agree. So that's all that this is saying, because we always have to match over the same surface. So my n plus is 1 over L d by d chi. My n minus is d by d rho, k plus alpha beta. Got a minus sign, just a sec. Okay, so the only sort of slight, I'm sort of hesitating here because I've noticed that I've got, I think there should be a minus sign here that somehow didn't make it into the notes. So in each case, what I've done, the thing that's slightly different about the Israel junction conditions versus what we did with boundaries, when we had a manifold with a boundary, we always had our normal inward pointing. So that is certainly true for this normal because it's pointing to increasing chi, which is pointing inwards. When you do the Israel junction conditions, because he derived them by integrating the Einstein equations through a highly localized planar object, you have on the plus side, your normal is inward pointing. On the minus side, it's outward pointing because you want the normal to be continuous through the surface. So this one is kind of opposite to what you would expect if you were just looking at a boundary. So that's just a sort of slight, you know, minus signs are the banes of our existence, I think, as theoretical physicists, but that's an example of one. Because Israel says take k plus minus k minus, because we've swapped the sign of the normal. And so that's what I've done here, k plus minus k minus. And of course, it's actually k plus delta k ab minus the trace of that times hab. So this is what I get. Remember that TAB is sigma HAB for a wall, and the Israel conditions are delta KAB minus delta KHAB are 8 pi G TAB. So my TAB is proportional to G, so all I've done is I've kind of traced this equation. So this gives me a relation between the, I've written it here in terms of rho wall. I could have written it in terms of sine or cos of chi w, because this thing here is just cos chi w, and this is, of course, looking like sine chi w. So my action, my Euclidean action, consists of two bulk terms, which is r plus 2 lambda. I hope it's sort of clear. There's a wall term, which is sigma. And then I've got the Gibbons-Hawking terms, which are going to give me I get a plus sign for the m plus and a minus sign for the m minus. So I've got k over 8 pi g. So hopefully that's sort of clear. So my bounce action is where I've done this integral and I subtract off the background, which is the de Sitter space. And the de Sitter space is simply the bulk integral m plus. So what I end up with from, let's look at the bulk piece. So if I subtract the background, what I've got is the integral of, for chi less than or equal to chi naught, of minus r plus 2 lambda over 16 pi g. So this is the contribution from m plus. If I look at m minus, that has zero vacuum energy. So I get no contribution from m minus here. Meanwhile, on the wall, I've got sigma, and then I've got delta k on 8 pi g. So that's just taking the difference between this solution and the background de Sitter. The only contribution to the bulk comes from de Sitter, So the only bit I get from this is the cap of the sphere. The wall I get from just integrating the energy of the wall, and then I've got the Gibbons-Hawking term there. So now I use the trace of Israel equation. So my delta K is minus 12 pi g sigma. R is for lambda. So B is the integral of lambda over 8 pi g, and my I'm integrating for chi less than chi naught, so that's my volume term, so that's the bulk. And then my wall piece is simply 2 pi squared, where the wall is, cubed times sigma over 2. So that's my wall integral. So I can easily do that sine cubed integral. So then I replace sigma, I'm not quite sure I can read my writing here, but hopefully that's correct. So what I've done in the wall piece is I've replaced rho wall. So I've replaced rho wall squared with sine squared. So that's using what rho L squared sine squared. Then I've taken the value of sigma here. So sigma times rho wall is 1 over 4 pi g times this combination, which is 1 minus cos. So that's how I get that term there. So I simply group together all these pieces now, which I've got things in terms of causes and sines. So I work that through and crank the handle, and I find this is what I get. But then I can turn this 1 minus cos back into a sigma. And so what I end up with here is, if I do that, I've got 2 pi g sigma squared rho wall squared pi L squared over g. But finally, I can invert this expression here to get rho wall in terms of sigma. And so what my final answer is pi L squared over G . So what I end up with is now an expression which is just in terms of the tension of the wall and the vacuum energy, because L is equivalent to the vacuum energy here. So you see that L squared is 3 over 8 pi g epsilon. So if I look at the dominant behavior, we've got an L to the sixth on the top. So divided L to the sixth, G to the fourth divided by G. So that gives me a GL squared cubed. So GL squared is like 1 over epsilon. So I get a 1 over epsilon cubed. Meanwhile, I've got a sigma to the fourth. So if I compare it to the boxed expression on the top board, that is the flat space, no gravity answer, and that is sigma to the fourth on epsilon cubed. So the limit as g goes to zero means that this extra term in square brackets kind of gets ignored, and that turns to one. The other g's, even though you might think, well, hang on, g's going to zero, so surely that whole expression goes to zero, but you've got to remember that g is packaged with L squared to give you one over epsilon. So if you do take the g go to zero limit of that, you get exactly Coleman's result. So it's all nice and consistent. So this is what Coleman and De Lucia derived. And if you want to know what it looks like as a picture, De Sitter is a four sphere, and then you cut it off, you cut the cap off and replace it with something that's flat. So that's your interior flat space time. From a Lorentzian perspective, you get a hyperboloid, which is also kind of chopped off. My art is really very suspect. But you take the hyperboloid and you simply cut through it and replace it with a flat slice. So that's what this looks like. And once again, Coleman says, take the surface at t equals zero, if you like, at which your bubble forms. So this is the bubble here. And then you allow that to evolve. So that's what your space-time looks like. But the space-time is, sorry, I should be clear. Our space-time is this surface. So this is, it's the surface, not the interior. So this is our space-time. So that's kind of how you visualize these instantons. So why are they called instantons? Well, if we go back to this picture here, they're localized in Euclidean time. So in some sense, it's as if they exist for an instant from, you know, sort of. So that's kind of where that terminology came from. Okay, so why was this important? Well, at the time, people were, thinking about the implications for these vacua for the early universe. And it was sort of realized that there were several problems with the standard cosmological model, which was still only like 20 years old at the time, following the discovery of the microwave background. Well, actually less, 15, because that was discovered in 65. And so it was realized, well, hang on, if we believe the universe had a finite start and then was hot, so it's radiation dominated, then how do we explain the fact that it's so uniformly at the same temperature? Because there's no causal physical process that allows it to sort of equilibrate. Then, of course, consequences of these complicated vacua were topological defects. We've seen the wall, but there are also strings and monopoles. And there was a sort of thought that there would be a monopole problem because in standard unification, your gauge group had such a structure that there would be magnetic monopoles in a generic phase transition. So it was realized there were various problems with the standard cosmological model. And sort of several people, but most notably Alan Guth, simultaneously realized that you could actually avoid these problems if you had a false vacuum energy, which allowed you to exponentially expand, which is called inflation, and that would dilute all of these defects as well as solving, you know, sort of making the universe win causal contact. But if you're in one of these false vacua, you have to get out because we are not in, well, we are actually in a lambda space, but it's very small lambda. And so you needed to know the tunneling amplitude. And the problem was that this tunneling probability was just too low. And so your universe would never exit. So that was why that was important. But it's interesting because this calculation of Coleman and others has become like the gold standard for calculating false vacuum decay. So when the mass of the Higgs was measured back in 2012, and the then existing mass range for the top quark, it was realized that the standard model vacuum was not actually stable. It looked more like the dotted line there, where the Higgs self-coupling turned around and became negative. So you have a sort of effective coupling of the Higgs of a sort of lambda of phi to the fourth, and this lambda phi here becomes negative at sort of anywhere from 10 to the 12, sort of 10 to the 14 or so GeV, roughly, some massive magnitude. And so people sort of were, well, oh dear, you know, our vacuum's metastable, do we have to worry? Used Coleman's result and said, no, we don't, because the answer is gives us a half-life of many, many billion, you know, tens and 10 to the 100 odd billion years. What then happened is, so some of the more recent research I've been doing was saying, well, if you've got gravity, first of all, this is very idealized. This geometry here is completely featureless. So we went through and did the calculation with black holes and found that if you had primordial black holes and you do the same calculation, all the techniques that we've been using, you've met them all, you could do it. You're doing the Israel equations, but instead of the pure de Sitter, you've got Schwarzschild de Sitter or whatever. And you find that the action of forming a bubble is lowered. And this is analogous to catalysis of in a first order phase transition. So when you get raindrops forming, they're seeded by little dust particles in the sky. So I noticed this from making cups of tea here by putting mugs in the microwave to heat up the water, because kettles take so long to boil over here compared to Britain. And so you put the tea bag in, and then suddenly everything whooshes up. Or Diet Coke and Mentos is another one. So the black hole sort of makes it much more likely that the vacuum decays. So there's some quite interesting recent stories. And also, people have been going back and questioning the Euclidean prescription, and something that's very, that I'm quite excited about, which I'm involved in, also Matt Johnson, who's here at Perimeter, is interested in this, is whether we can build analog systems, so systems out of cold atoms, that have false vacua. Can we build an actual tabletop experiment that behaves like a relativistic false vacuum and therefore test some of these ideas? Because, of course, there's so many kind of reaching steps here. We're reaching in terms of our field theory Euclidean calculations. I mean, it seems reasonable, but we haven't had a direct experimental verification. And we're even further reaching when we add gravity. So it'd be really nice to test some of these things. Anyway, well done. We've come to the end of the course. I've tried to give you, first of all, a grounding in more advanced gravity, as well as giving you a selection of advanced topics in gravity. And I hope, even if you're not a sort of card-carrying gravitational physicist, that you've at least had fun hearing about some of these advanced topics in gravity. So thank you.